The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of September, 2021, on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up on today's program, the leader of Germany's Social Democrats, Olaf Scholz, begins work on building a coalition.
We will be very fast in getting a result for this government, and it should be before Christmas, if possible.
Also ahead, we'll explore why the Greek and French governments are promising closer military cooperation. Bloomberg's Ewan Potts will also have the day's latest business news, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lucinda Elliott will have a roundup of news from Latin America. Faye, what can we look forward to?
Hi, Daniel. We'll be talking about the close relationship of the SPD with the Brazilian left, plus the end of the soap opera Physical Soundtrack.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. After narrowly winning Sunday's national election, Germany's Social Democrats say they hope to talk to the Greens and the Free Democrats later this week about forming a three-way government. The Greens and the Liberal FDP, who have little in common on many issues, say they will first attempt to seek areas of compromise before starting negotiations with the bigger parties. Let's get the latest now with Quentin Peel from Chatham House, the think tank here in London, also a former FT Berlin correspondent. Quentin, good afternoon to you. Thanks for coming in. What do you make of the announcement that these negotiations will be taking place before there are conversations with the bigger parties about forming a government?
Well, I think that actually the most logical thing is for the Greens and the Free Democrats, the Liberals, to get together and then go to the Social Democrats and say, OK, we can live together. Now let's all talk about it. I'm not quite sure how it's going to work, but I do think it's increasingly obvious that we're likely to get what's called a traffic light coalition of the red Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Liberals, whose colour is yellow. And I think that would be interesting, and it's the logic of the elections that the Christian Democrats will go into opposition with their tails between their legs. And I think Armin Laschet, their candidate for Chancellor, would probably resign.
That is a bold prediction. We heard the clip off the top there, obviously, from Olaf Scholz saying this is all possible for Christmas. He's very much playing himself as the leader, as the role of chancellor. Now, is this for sure that we'll see this coalition?
Nothing's quite for sure. Something like 80% of Germans say they want Olaf Scholz as the next chancellor. They clearly see him as the natural successor to Angela Merkel rather than the man she wanted, Armin Laschet. So I think from that point of view, he's probably right. I must say it's quite funny to hear him say, we're going to do this very quickly. We'll have a government by Christmas. Hey, that's 3 months away. But that would be very German.
Well, what do you make of these negotiations between the smaller parties we began by talking about? They're quite far apart. So where can they first find some common ground?
Well, they're both social liberals, social, not economic liberals. So on economics, the Free Democrats are really pretty conservative, therefore very strict budget control, and they don't want to see taxes go up, particularly on the wealthier and the business sector. Whereas the Greens want to finance a very tough anti-climate change program, and right. so they're looking for higher taxes. That's the most difficult area. But I think on foreign policy, let's be clear, all these three parties are very pro-European, very pro-European integration, very much in favour of the Franco-German relationship. So in that area too, I think the differences are probably less difficult.
You mentioned the idea of Armin Laschet going into opposition as the leader there. What is the next move for him? Obviously, he's probably not counting himself out at this point. So how do they go forward, and what is the next step for the Christian Democrats?
I think Armin Laschet's fighting for his political life. Mm. That the reason why he's saying I too could be chancellor is that actually if he ain't going to be chancellor, I think he's out of a job. Or else he goes back to North Rhine-Westphalia, where after all he is the prime minister there. But it's a tough one. I mean, undoubtedly he had a bad election campaign, and this is a very poor result for the Christian Democrats, and there's a lot of backstabbing going on in the party. I think they'll want to see fresh blood, if not in this year, then in the next 18 months.
Many people looked at Angela Merkel as sort of the leader of Europe and one of the big leaders in the European Union, obviously. We talk about these, well, quick in German terms, but a couple of months to form a coalition government. Will the EU partners be a little bit nervous? Obviously, France has a massive election coming up soon as well. So what are the hopes here on getting this done relatively quickly? Obviously, there's a lot happening in the EU right now.
Yeah, I think there is nervousness that there'll be a period of sort of lack of reaction from Germany, just because they won't have a functioning government. Mm. Let's be clear. Angela Merkel will still be the caretaker chancellor, and therefore probably till Christmas. So there's a certain consistency there with policy, but the key decision at the European level is to go ahead with this massive bond raising program to finance all the pandemic spending, which Germany under Merkel had finally sort of rolled over and said yes to. The question is, will they really throw their weight behind that? If you have a free Democrat finance minister in a red, green, yellow government, that finance minister could be pretty tough on European spending.
Obviously, Olaf Scholz was the former finance minister, deputy chancellor. Is that part of the reason why he's so popular right now in the eyes of Germans, regular Germans who want him to be the chancellor?
Yeah, it's fascinating, really. I mean, he's a pretty dull guy. I mean, he's a nice guy. He's got a nice smile, but he doesn't set anybody alight. And I think that's what people basically, rather nicely put by one of my friends there, who said, the Germans have voted for change, but with the handbrake on. Mm. And that's really, he's the sort of handbrake on too much change. They voted for a pretty centrist sort of government.
You mentioned the pandemic spending and the way forward to reboot Germany's economy. Obviously, the smaller kingmaker, we can say, parties want to play a big role in that. What is the big crisis for Germany right now? What else are they facing down the road and need to work on? Obviously, things like climate change and more broadly working with the European Union are important, but what else is sort of on the shelf there that will be important to tackle for the next government?
I think the biggest criticism of the last years of Merkel is a failure to invest in the big future. So digital investment, actually get German digital infrastructure up to the same sort of level that you have in many other countries, US, China, even UK. Germany's lagging behind. And then getting their industry actually ready for climate change or ready to resist climate change. Mm. Those are very big challenges, quite apart from, we know there's going to be still challenges of immigration, challenges of living with Russia, living with China. All these things haven't gone away.
Lots to watch there, and I'm sure we'll be returning to this regularly. Quentin, thank you for that. That is Quentin Peel with me here in studio. Now here's Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. North Korea has conducted another short-range missile test over its eastern coast. It came as North Korea's ambassador told the United Nations that no one could deny Pyongyang's right to test weapons and self-defense. North Korea conducted both ballistic and cruise missile tests earlier this month. Sydney's officials say residents who are not vaccinated against COVID-19 risk being barred from various social activities, even when stay-at-home orders end in December. Those who choose not to be vaccinated could be barred entry to shops, restaurants and entertainment venues when restrictions are lifted. The leader of France's far right, Marine Le Pen, says she will call a referendum on immigration if she is elected as the country's next president. Le Pen added that the vote would propose drastic limits on immigration and strict criteria for entering French territory and acquiring French citizenship. And Milan is pondering how to deal with its fascist-era architecture. Even though many of the city's key buildings, including the Central Railway Station, Stock Exchange and Palace of Justice, were erected during Mussolini's rule, their past is not often explicitly signposted. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Emma. The Greek government has been holding talks with France over an attempt to boost military cooperation between the countries. With Athens attempting to bolster its armed forces, its longstanding ally France has agreed to supply the Greeks with fighter jets and frigates. Let's get the latest now from Monocle contributor Mary Fitzgerald. Mary, normally based in the French city of Marseille, currently joins us on the line from the Greek island of Edra. Mary, thanks for joining us. First, what's in this deal?
Well, apart from the fact that the deal will include up to $5 billion worth of elements related to warships, so it could include up to 6 warships, 3 frigates set for delivery starting in 2025. This is on top of the fact that Greece has also earlier this year agreed to purchase several Rafale fighter jets from France. But this, what's important about today's announcement is that this is not simply about sales. Key to this deal agreed today is a mutual defense clause. Now, the details of that have yet to be revealed, despite the fact that Emmanuel Macron and the Greek Prime Minister had a press conference earlier today. But really, this is what people are intrigued about, because, of course, that prompts the question of whether or how France might act when it comes to the idea of backing Greece if we see tensions flare up again between Athens and Ankara, as we saw last year. And of course, this has been a recurring thing in relations between Greece and Turkey. So that's the key question there. Some defense specialists have also been wondering about this mutual defense clause, asking whether we will see Greek cooperation, for example, with when it comes to French operations abroad, whether that's the Barkhane operation in Mali, et cetera, across the Sahel. So it raises a lot of very interesting questions. Also very interesting rhetoric from the Greek prime minister. He made the point today that this deal will tie us, that being France and Greece, together for decades. Very interesting.
Well, very interesting indeed. And beyond sort of the strategic alliance in the Eastern Mediterranean, as you say, I'm curious as what else is important for both of these partners in coming together here in the long term, as you suggest.
Well, it's also, of course, very striking that this comes on the foot of Australia cancelling the submarine deal with France very recently. We know that Paris took that very, very hard indeed. It's interesting that it's actually the French defense company that was supposed to make those submarines is going to now be at the heart of this deal with Greece. It was interesting to hear Macron at the press conference to announce this deal in terms of he was talking about European strategic autonomy, the relationship between European countries. He said Europeans must stop being naive. This is not new rhetoric from Macron, but the fact that he's very much talking about the Franco-Greek relationship in these terms is interesting. And of course, the reaction from other key EU member states, particularly Germany, is also, I think, interesting in that we've seen in recent years that when people talk about European strategic autonomy, that tends to be a conversation that is driven by France, where other countries, including Germany, are a little bit more wary of it.
You mentioned the importance of this deal for France at this time after the deal was with Australia was obviously scuppered. I'm curious how important these types of military deals will be for France and President Macron at the time more broadly, and particularly with other NATO states.
Well, you know, I think the fact that it comes on the foot of the cancellation of the submarine deal is a big boost for the French defense industry. There are also questions looking at some of the commentary in the Greek media today, questions about the Greek defense budget. You know, Greece has been repeatedly cutting its defense budget since the economic crisis of 2005, but we're seeing an uptick in spending in the last couple of years, which is interesting given that it comes as we see tensions growing between Ankara and Athens. But more generally, I think what's interesting about this deal is the fact that it brings Greece and France closer together in what we know is more intensely geopolitical space around the Mediterranean in recent years. And that's for a number of reasons, including the fact that Russia is more present around the Mediterranean now. It's in Syria. It's also in Libya. That wasn't the case some years ago. So we're talking about a more intensely geopolitical space around that Mediterranean. And that, of course, is influencing French and Greek calculations.
Mary, thank you for this. That was Mary Fitzgerald joining us from the Greek island of Edra. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Organic solvents are as natural to chemistry as the ubiquitous test tubes. But the fossil origin of some widely used solvents, which are also used in drug development, are a threat to the environment. Special soap-like substances that can work like nanomachines might dissolve part of this toxic problem and help chemistry become more natural. Fabrice Galou is an award-winning chemist who works as a principal fellow at the Chemical Analytical Development Unit at Novartis. Galou understands, perhaps better than most, that chemistry is an old science and that many processes have stayed the same for decades. Changing them, even if this were to have a beneficial effect on the environment, is difficult not only technically, but also for cultural reasons. Nevertheless, change is at hand.
I'm Fabrice Galou. I'm a chemist in technical research development. I'm part of a team making medicines. My dream is to make these medicines in a radically different manner, utilizing the most sustainable resources that we have available to us. With the new technologies we recently discovered and implemented in our processes, we're able to not only make a difference for patients via access to the medicines, but also to the society.
Since joining Novartis in 2006, Galou has developed new ideas on how to improve some of the standard chemical processes used in drug development. He helped to launch the so-called Green Chemistry Group, which today encompasses a loose group who focus on establishing new process and synthesis protocols using new classes of solvents. Since the Green Chemistry team began its efforts, the group has worked on dozens of early phase compounds, some of which are now in late stage development. Just another of the ways in which Novartis is reimagining medicine.
You're back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bage. We're going to get a roundup of some of the day's main business headlines now with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us on the line. Good afternoon, Ewan. No let-up in rising European energy markets. Tell us about that.
Daniel, yes, a whole host of fresh records in the energy sector today. German power prices, carbon futures, and the benchmark Dutch natural gas all soaring to records today. Dutch natural gas futures surging as much as 12%. Now, the energy crisis right across Europe is showing few signs of improving anytime soon. Demand continuing to roar ahead from that pandemic-driven lull, and concerns about the stock of gas as we head into winter. Now, a report from Bloomberg NEF analyst says that Europe's supply-demand balance will remain unusually tight heading into the winter, adding further price pressures to a market already at record highs. Now, in the UK, we've seen many small electricity suppliers collapse. The signs that the French electricity market is also struggling. A number of retailers having difficulty supplying clients there, and also at risk of folding. And Europe's miners warning that the unprecedented prices could disrupt the shift away from fossil fuels. We're also seeing oil prices surge, trading above $80 a barrel, Brent crude, for the first time since October 2018. And if that weren't enough already, also pressure on water in Norway. Now, Norway generates a lot of power through hydropower, which is exported to the UK and across to other parts of the Nordic region. And the operator there, Statnett, saying that electricity supplies in the southwest are pressed because of low inflows and falling stockpiles. Now, a lot of this rally stems from the gas storage situation. We had a very cold, long winter last time. That means that storage is depleted, and Russia has not been pumping as much over the summer months as was expected. So storage for this time of year is rather low than expected. So more energy prices at records today.
And let's cross to China now, where power suppliers feeling the pressure there as well.
Yeah, if you think this is a European story, then take a look at what is happening in China. It's interesting, not just because it's the world's second largest economy, but also, of course, because it is the workshop of the world. So a lot of manufacturing activity in China being disrupted by their electricity crunch. Now, this has been going on for some time, and it doesn't seem like the situation is getting any better. Chinese manufacturers warning that strict measures to cut electricity use is going to slash output. This is taking place in about a third of provinces across China. Local governments are ordering power cuts as they try to avoid missing targets for emissions, because China produces a lot of its power from coal, which is very polluting, and the government is trying to limit that. There's also, in some parts of China, an actual lack of electricity. Just give you one example of a company which exports polyester and nylon fabric. They say they've suffered huge losses due to the suspension. Since September, they've been told they can only operate 3 days a week, and the latest order means they can only operate every other day. So this is the sort of restrictions in place for a number of manufacturers. And also we're seeing some threat of power cuts for domestic customers in China. They've been asked in some regions to reduce their electricity usage. And of course, all of this comes at a very bad time for manufacturers. They're racing to meet demand for the Christmas holiday period, toys and clothing being ordered by companies in the West. So not very good timing for China's electricity crunch.
Ewan, thank you for this. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's program, it's time to get the latest news from Latin America. Our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is here with me in studio. And joining us on the line from Uruguay is our correspondent in the region, Lucinda Elliott. Fernando, let's begin with you here. We started the show by talking about coalition talks in Germany. There is a very interesting connection to the leadership in Brazil and Bolsonaro. Tell us about that.
Well, very much so. In fact, the German election outcome is very bad news for Bolsonaro, and I'll explain why. Basically, the SPD have a very close relationship with the Brazilian left, especially with Lula. It started in the 80s even, when Helmut Schmidt was in Brazil for a state visit, and Brazil was under the military dictatorship at the time. But he asked to meet Lula at the time, who was kind of this, you know, this leader wanting democracy for the country. A former leader of SPD, Martin Schulz, as well, visited Lula in prison when he was in Curitiba only a few years ago, back in 2013 as well, when SPD had their grand 150 years party. Lula was one of the main kind of guest speakers at the event. And besides that, of course, you have the Greens, who are so powerful. And of course, they disagree very much of Bolsonaro environmental policies. And Germany is a strong partner to Brazil, so I think it would be very difficult for those countries to have any sort of commercial deals, at least during this year of transition, as Brazil is having an election next year as well.
How has this been picked up in the media in Brazil this week?
Well, it's a pretty big deal. I think Brazil already covers how Bolsonaro doesn't get on very well with other leaders. Of course, we had the situation with Macron again. France is a very important economic partner of Brazil, but like those countries, they have a very frosty relationship, which, you know, even went down to the gutter as well when Bolsonaro, you know, said things about Macron's wife, which, I mean, a leader should never have to do that. So, of course, the Brazilian media is very much paying attention to that topic.
Lucinda, I want to bring you in here. Great to speak to you, as ever. Some interesting parallels to talk about between Donald Trump and his old friend Bolsonaro. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Yeah, there was an interesting article by one of Ewan's colleagues at Bloomberg actually published this week looking at Bolsonaro's ties to the Trump administration, you know, another embattled leader who had become increasingly isolated to the world towards the end of his presidential term. And it argues that while many foreign heads of state have moved on after Trump's defeat in November, that Bolsonaro has really sort of he's clinging on to the Trump world. He's really doubled down on that campaign formula and is drawing on very close advisors such as Steve Bannon in the run-up to the next vote, which is scheduled for October in Brazil. So, for example, you know, Bolsonaro has been attacking Brazil's Congress, top judges, you know, saying that they're corrupt. He's stating without evidence that his opponents are hijacking the voting systems. And what really stood out to me is how interlinked the Bolsonaro family and clan still is to the Trump family, as we've seen from social media. Eduardo Bolsonaro, his son, who advises his father on foreign affairs, regularly goes to the States with Trump and his children. But also this year, Trump's son, Donald Jr., was a keynote speaker at a conservative conference in Brazil. Then another key ally, Jason Miller, who was Trump's former spokesman, gave a talk in person at the same event. So one to watch, you know, whether this sort of international recognition somehow fires up Bolsonaro's voter base. We saw a lot of sort of US flags and signs written, albeit in terrible English, during the rally in support of Bolsonaro earlier this month. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see in the run up to October.
And Lucinda, we're going to take a very hard turn now to talk about llamas. Anytime anyone brings up Donald Trump, I just hope for an animal story, and you've set us up perfectly today. Talk to me about COVID immune therapy and Fifi.
Yeah, so this llama called Fifi has shown significant potential in early trials of a new COVID treatment. It's a treatment made of nanobodies, which are smaller, simpler versions of antibodies, which llamas and also camels produce naturally in response to infection. And scientists are all very excited about this because they say that once the therapy has been tested in humans, it could be given as a simple nasal spray to treat and even prevent early infection. It's the lead researcher is at the Rosalind Franklin Institute in Oxfordshire, explained that these South American animals treated with this new nasal spray fully recovered from the virus within 6 days, which is remarkable.
And we strongly encourage people to Google a picture of Fifi smiling as llamas do. Very happy to help with this therapy, I think. Fernando, lastly, we're going to talk about soap opera soundtracks, which are finished. Tell us about that.
This is actually quite sad, I think, to me and many Brazilians. So basically, our main broadcaster, Globo, they decided to stop, launching physical soundtracks for their soap operas. Because I have to tell you, Daniel, for every single soap opera from that network, they used to have a soundtrack which go on sale, and those albums became bestsellers. I remember the first album I bought was the soundtrack of a soap opera, in fact. So, and if you're an artist and your song is in a soap opera at the time, that means you will do well. That means you will be in the charts. It's not the same anymore, and I think that's why Globo decided. Because I think, of course, there's still music in soap operas, and there's still kind of playlists on Spotify, but it's a bit different. And may I even criticize them a little bit? Because in the past, you know, the directors used to work with musicians to do specific songs for the soap. Now they just kind of use any kind of random tracks. There's a lack of curatorship almost in a way, which is a very, very sad loss for all Brazilians.
Is there any way back for that part of the industry, do you think? Is it a space for artists to continue to grow?
I mean, I think the physical album, it is very difficult, especially in the Brazilian music market. And Brazilians, you know, they move to digital very quickly, faster than many countries. But I think there's still space, you know, to have, a playlist online and to invite artists because people like it. I mean, people are still watching soap operas. The numbers are still doing well. So why soundtracks can't do the same as well?
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much to both Lucinda Elliott and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That is it for today's edition of The Briefing, produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow, 1300 in Zurich, midday here in London. Almost time to go, but before we do, Fernando, here's a little blast of the very first soap opera soundtrack that you bought. Let's have a listen.
Please don't need to know. seven days.